Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man, he's not my cup of tea, it's Richard Herring! Adelaide, hello! Welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. But you know, the other day I was talking to some of John Robbins and Ellis James' PCDs. Pretty cool lot of people, I think you will agree. And not sad idiots who like a pair of losers. And they call it Renaissance. I don't know if that's going to catch on. So I was very excited. I'd written a brilliant routine. I'd kind of typed it up. It was on my phone, and then my phone literally just deleted it just as I was about to come on stage. I genuinely can't believe that the attachment's gone. So I just have to do what I usually do and dick around. I don't know if you saw in the news, as we were recording this the week before, Cheddar Man is back in the news. Yeah, the worst superhero of all time. He was bitten by a radioactive piece of cheese, and his superpower is that he gets a bit sweaty if he isn't in a fridge. That's all I can remember from that brilliant routine I wrote. Having looked at it, the exciting thing is, you may know about Cheddar Man, they did a DNA test on this. There's a skeleton they found in Cheddar Caves in 1906, and it's 10,000 years old, and it's still the most famous person to ever come out of Cheddar. It's never had a BBC Two series, but still internationally known Skellington is still the most famous. About 20 years ago, they did a DNA test and discovered it was related to my history teacher, Mr. Target, who lives 100 yards from Cheddar Caves. So his family have moved that far in 10,000 years' time. But more excitingly, this time they've discovered, maybe seen it, that he's probably was dark-skinned. He had blue eyes, dark skin. Though I have to say, looking at him, kind of slightly weird colouring, and I did sort of worry that he's like all the Cheddar residents in the 1980s on Halloween. Just there's a little cheeky glint in his eye and he's smiling. The blue eyes staring from much too orange. So it's good to see that that tradition lasted 10,000 years. Stop now. They wouldn't do that in Cheddar now. That would be inappropriate. Good. Shame I didn't have that to read out. It would have gone better. I wrote it so beautifully. I'll just find it and put that over the top. So it'll be fine. Anyway, my guest this week is probably best known. You're much better than last week's audience, by the way. Is probably best known as the programme associate on one episode of Harry Hill's TV Birth. She's not the only one. It's Danielle Ward, ladies and gentlemen! Come in. Sit down. You don't have to. I didn't do it to John and Ellis. I was just very happy to see you. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
Good, I'm very glad.
These are very deep, aren't they?
I was a programme associate on Harry Hill's TV Birth for one episode as well.
How did you manage it?
I didn't like it. It was too hard.
But how did you... Why did you get the job of programme associate?
Because I'm extremely funny and they wanted me to be involved.
Can I tell you how I got that?
How did you get it?
I was sleeping with one of the writers and on a Sunday morning he made me watch Casualty and I came up with one joke.
Okay.
And I got a credit.
Okay.
Just by...
Damn, if I'd known it was that easy.
That's the only job I've ever slept my way to.
Wow.
I think it was matching jumper and scalp on Casualty. I think it was that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was worth it.
Yeah.
It was worth it. Good. So you've just had a baby, and I wouldn't usually talk about this quite recent though, and you've had a baby with a York City sporting comedian.
Yeah.
And it isn't me. How did this happen?
Yeah, I had a baby 13 weeks ago.
That's crazy. What are you doing out?
I know. But then I went to the BBC Christmas party after 4 weeks.
Did you?
Yes, so, and that was fine.
Well, I think it's good to get out quickly. We went to Buckingham Palace. We weren't invited.
For
we just
approval.
Went there. We went, a month after our daughter was born, I had been invited for some reason to a dinner party with Princess Anne at Buckingham Palace for a charity that I have nothing to do with.
Oh. It was a bit. I didn't know whether to bring it up. Like, it was a bit different for us because our daughter has a heart condition. I don't know if you saw, and so she had to have open heart surgery at 5 days old.
Yeah.
So we were in intensive care for 3 weeks. So when we got home, we're like, we have to go out. Like, I basically lived in. It was like a dirty hotel. Oh, no, that sounds may sound really awful. Thank you, Great Ormond Street. It's lovely. It was really weird and dirty and like this grimy little accommodation opposite Great Ormond Street for 3 weeks. And so it was like any opportunity. I was so excited to be home with a baby that was well and out.
Yes, of course.
I went a bit nuts.
I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, went out all the time.
It's difficult. Never in. Hey, you spent the first 3 weeks with them. What more do they want?
Exactly. And she was fine.
Yeah, that's good. She's fine. That's good to know. It's tough, though. That first 3 months especially are difficult, and then the next 18 years. So look out for that. They're all pretty bad. But they give you diseases. That's the problem. That's where I am.
Have you
today.
Got a disease?
I've got a disease.
It's from just, which? What, your daughter or your son?
Well, both of them. It's both dirty little pests. They pick up everything. It's probably my daughter. My daughter goes to nursery now, and that's nice.
Yeah, that's great.
Gets her out of the house, but you know, then she comes back with all the diseases from the other kids.
So what we've
the I other don't know. Kids in the village who are all dirty, not like us.
So when we had our daughter at UCLH, which is just down the road, and what they do as practice is they give every baby that's born the BCG. Because of TB, which has been eradicated in most countries, but there's loads of it in Camden for some reason.
Right.
And they were saying, oh, so, you know, if your baby had been born like in another part of the country, we wouldn't have to give her this, but there's loads of TB in Camden. So if you're worried about like getting a bug from nursery, from your posh, wherever you live now, it's a posh place, try living in Camden. They've got TB.
So. I'm going to try and live there, and that'll show you. It was having TB. The loads of comedy people got together because of TB. Who was it? The two writers who got together because they had TB. TB was the Simpson and the Golden Simpson. You're correct. And also Robert Lindsay had TB. I saw he showed a picture of himself as a kid, thanking the NHS for saving his life.
Oh.
Just as by the by. So there you go. So TB's not all bad. That's what I'm going to say. That TB, no Stepton son, I think. Is that right? Yeah, good. Does pretty well. And that Joe Stepton son in 1970 got 20.5 million viewers. It was like the... And that wasn't even the top programme of the year.
What was the top programme?
It was. I'll tell you what it was. It was Miss World. This is a tweet I saw today. Miss World, 1970, was the top, something like 30 million. Second was Apollo 13 splashing down. So Miss World got more than Apollo 13, the people being saved, their lives being saved as they splashed into the ocean.
It's been amazing.
What, Miss World?
Miss World.
It was great. It was great. Just girls drew around. It was no problems. You could slap them on the ass and no one said a thing. It was brilliant. Oh, what do you mean? Sorry, the Apollo 13.
We all got really bored of them Chilean miners. Yeah. It's on all the time. You got rolling news. You're like, oh, are they out yet? No.
Imagine getting 30 million. Isn't that incredible, though, that people got, like a comedy show got 20 million viewers?
Yeah, that's because...
So that every, you know, that's half the country at that point probably were watching one television program. The viewing figures for this are similar. Eventually, after about a million years, we'll be there. If this stays up on YouTube, it probably will. So Danielle, people might be aware of you from lots of different places, and they might not be aware of you
probably
at all.
Probably not at all, but yeah.
But you do lots of podcasts, which might be the in for a lot of people, and we should.
Yes.
Fantastic podcasts. Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing. Can you name any other podcasts I do?
You do the film one, the film Fandango.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, thank you. I do research. Your husband, boyfriend, you married?
No.
Disgusting. has been nominated for an award, the Chortle Award for Best Internet Show.
Which yeah, he's up against Jim,
He does a thing where he's parodying comedians interviewing other comedians.
Yeah.
Don't know where he gets his crazy ideas from. He supports York City, though, so I can say no bad thing about it.
But that isn't my podcast.
No, but I'm saying...
You might know me from my boyfriend's podcast.
Just saying, I know some other podcasts. I'm just saying. There's Adam Buxton does one.
He does one, yeah.
In fact, Do the Right Thing is an extraordinary... And it became a TV pilot.
Yes, a pilot that never got picked up.
I think because they... It's my producer Ben Walker is also the producer of your...
He is, yes.
And I think it's a very good and well thought out, and you've done it for several years, because I was on it about 6 or 7 years ago, so you've been doing it for a long time. And it's a really good teams of people. Michael Legg's on it. He's all right. He's disappointing. Yeah. But Margaret's brilliant. You're brilliant. And it's the right people to do it, I think. And you've worked out how the format works. So it's kind of giving moral dilemmas and people have to...
Actually, that's where it differs.
Oh, really?
Because I had a Radio 4 show called Dilemma, and that was moral dilemmas.
Yes, that was moral
dilemmas. And so legally, I've had to invent a different thing, legally, so that different. And Do the Right Thing is actually practical problems.
Yes, well, it is.
It's legally, technically different. Because the BBC own 20% of Dilemma, whereas I own 80%. But Do the Right Thing, me and Ben, 50-50.
No, that's good. Well, it is different. I think you asked me about how do you get rid of... Someone's got an erection, how do you get rid of it? I think
you wouldn't do that on Radio 4.
That's not a moral question.
That's not a moral dilemma,
that's just hit it with a pencil. That's the answer.
What did you say? Was that your answer?
Well, because I had a friend who worked in sexual health, and sometimes men would come to her with sexually transmitted diseases, and she was a pretty young woman.
Yeah.
And they would sometimes become, aroused.
And she would...
By having their penises out, their diseased penises out in front of a woman. And weirdly, she wasn't that interested in these strange diseased penises, so she would find a way to get rid
would
of them.
She
and
hit
she said
it?
Hit it with a pencil was her advice.
She didn't hit it with a pencil herself.
No, she said hit it with a pencil.
But she didn't get it penciled out and...
She got a pencil out. She had a pencil already.
Like
she was making notes. VD. That's what she was. He has got VD. Stop that, mister. And that's enough to put men off the shock.
Yeah. Does that work?
I don't know. I've never done it to anyone. And when I get an erection, I want it to stay. So I don't... I'm not... It's rare enough now. And if it's up there, I might use a pencil just to help support it a bit. In the early stages. I'm not bad. It's not bad for a 50-year-old. It's not bad. It takes a little, but you get the engines running, haven't you, mate? Yeah, and once the engine's up and running, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Don't pretend you don't. But you did, though. I thought it was interesting because you took it to TV, and then Claudia Winkleman, who I love and think is great, was involved.
She was really good,
She's but it's sort of, it's weird the way TV can't just go, well, you've done really well here with this thing, let's give it a crack, because it clearly works.
Well, We did a pilot of Do the Right Thing with Claudia Winkleman, who is the most famous woman on British television. Strictly Come Dancing gets the highest viewing figures of anything, apart from Blue Planet, and we couldn't have got a whale or anything. So we had Claudia, and she was great, and she was really funny, and that we had a really great, I think we had Joe Lycett, Sarah Pascoe, Bridget Christie, Rich Dayardi, really great people on the show. And it was a good pilot, and there was like this chat about, they were like, oh, I don't think Claudia's right for it. Is there anybody, can you think of anybody else? Can we have a list of other potential people who could host it? And on the list was Samuel L. Jackson. Famously is very good on panel shows. Do you know, my favourite ever commissioning story is... there's a thing on Radio 4 called Chain Reaction.
Yes.
And it's where people interview other people. And my favourite ever commissioning story is my friend was the producer on it, and she went to someone at Radio 4 who was quite high up. And it was Lenny Henry who was on it. And they said, we think it'd be really great to get someone else to interview Lenny Henry who was black, basically. I mean, she didn't even use that term. She said, someone who was like Lenny Henry. It'd be really great if we could get him. And she got a list back of potential names to interview Lenny Henry. And this was maybe... 8 years ago.
Yep.
And on the list of people to interview Lenny Henry was Morgan Freeman, Whoopi Goldberg, and Richard Pryor. The dead Richard Pryor. I mean, that's why you've got to have a smile when dealing with these people.
That's why Samuel L. Jackson was on your list, because they left him off the last time.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a... Like, there were some really great people that we worked with at Channel 4, but...
I had a very good meeting with Channel 4 last week as well. So, I got something commissioned, then new people took over, and...
Yeah.
And it's... Well... Judging by the way the meeting kind of got up and moved out the door before we'd really ended it.
Yeah.
and sort of ended in the corridor, me getting in a lift. Very weird. I don't think that show's going to get made by Channel 4, but we'll see. She did say we'd meet up next week, but... It's next week now, so...
Have you thought about... You put Scarlett Moffat in it.
I'll do that. I'm going to change Noel Fielding, because he's not big enough on Channel 4, for Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
And Richard Pryor is going to be Ben Bailey-Smith.
He was very good in Superman 3. He'd be excellent.
He was.
He
was very good in Marlon Brando, from what I hear, as well.
That's an amazing bit of... Yes. Tittle-tattle, isn't it?
Well, if true. I mean, I suppose it's tittle-tattle.
Quincy Jones said it was true.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor's wife said it was true.
Yeah, but Richard Pryor's daughter said it wasn't true. And we all tell our daughters if you've had gay sex with a living legend. I mean, I'd just feel awkward if I was Marlon Brando, you know, because you'd have to get butter out and everything, wouldn't you? Because it's a bit like that film I did, isn't it?
Butter's a good lubricant.
I don't think it is.
No.
You know, Marlon Brando wasn't to know that. let's not go there. So do your own. Let's see what else you have done. Yeah. Well, I love your Edinburgh shows. You've done when I was looking, I've been a fan of yours, and I've seen most of your Edinburgh shows, I think, if not all of them, and. I was sort of like surprised by how many things you've done. You've done a lot of stuff.
No, I've done a lot of stuff for someone this unsuccessful.
But it's better. I know you feel like that, and I know you feel like you've not been recognised as much as you should, which is true. But also, you've carried on and you've made all these amazing and ambitious projects. So a lot of people just do stand-up shows, and you've done stand-up-y shows or like one-woman shows. But you've done like big musicals. You've done small musicals.
Yep.
You've done, you know, you've done karaoke circus, which is like this incredible thing where you get comedians in to come and with a band, and you have to rehearse these things. So you're doing these very ambitious projects, and they work and they keep going.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, that's you can be proud of
futile.
That.
Futile.
It's not futile, though. I know you've...
art projects.
No, but that's... But that, if you're still here...
With
and
no
still,
financial gain.
Doesn't matter. If you're still here and you're still doing them, then that's what matters, I think. You know, I think as you get older, I think you do realise that. I think most comedians go through this period of thinking, why is this amazing? And there are amazing things you've done, and they have had some recognition. You've won some awards, and you've had lovely reviews. And
musicals are in the British Library.
There you go.
Yeah.
My blogs are as well, so
that's how
that's how weak that is. And you know, so you've done. So Sister Psycho was one of the first things I saw you do, which was which was a kind of crazy musical
Very weird. A killer lesbian robotic nun.
Yeah.
Who steals a baby, keeps it in a cupboard, turns out the baby's Elton John. It was a lot of fun. And I always forgot that for years, Martin White, who was he wrote the music, he'd say to me, "Do you remember when Benedict Cumberbatch gave us a standing ovation?" And I don't, like, you know, bits of information just drop out your head.
Yeah.
I was like, did he? I don't, like, and apparently Benedict Cumberbatch's favourite ever Fringe show.
There you go.
Yeah, and he wasn't even famous then. So I didn't care.
I saw Benedict Cumberbatch in the toilet at Buckingham Palace.
Really? Yeah. When you went out after your...
Yeah, it was the same. I've only been to Buckingham Palace. Well, I actually have been to Buckingham Palace twice, but Benedict Cumberbatch was only there once.
I saw Emma Bunton in a toilet once.
Did you?
And she was very thin.
Was she?
Yeah.
Did she just done a big poo? like Benedict Cumberbatch, I went in the loo at Buckingham Palace, and he was standing there talking to someone. He looked at me, and you kind of think, "Oh God, you're Benedict Cumberbatch," you know.
Did you think he was going to go, "Oh, it's Richard Harris"?
No, well, that's why I didn't even consider that. So I just didn't say anything and walked out. But you kind of go sometimes, and when you say something like that, Benedict Cumberbatch was coming to a Fringe shows.
Yeah.
You go, maybe Benedict Cumberbatch was going, "Oh, Richard Harris, rude, isn't he?" I mean, I really like his Fringe shows, and he came into the toilet, just looked away, and looked embarrassed, and walked out like I was nothing. But I was sort of so overwhelmed that Benedict Cumberbatch, Victoria Wood was there. It was amazing.
In the toilet.
Michael Ball was there. Greg Davies was there.
I thought when you said you'd gone to Buckingham Palace, you'd gone as a day trip.
Mm.
But this sounds like a proper
party. We went to have dinner with Princess Anne. It
Why?
Was quite. It might not have happened. I was
Why
a month after my daughter was born. You know what it's like. Anything could. I don't know. I was. I do lots
Why
of work.
Why
were
you invited?
I do lots of work with Scope, and the guy who used to work for Scope now worked for Merck Neuron Disease, and I think he was trying to make, because I've raised loads of money for Scope. I think he was trying to get me to go over to Merck Neuron Disease, and to be honest, Scope had never got me taken to Buckingham Palace, so fuck them. I'm with the old MNDs now. That's their my lot.
I've actually got a...
Fuck the cerebral palsy lot. I'm with the motor neuron ones now. Because I had a nice cake.
Did it work? Is that what they do? Do charities wine and dine you?
I think they do, yeah. But I don't know why they did it to me. It was very nice. I was sitting next to Nick Knowles' now ex-wife.
Oh, that story starts so well in a toilet. Nick Knowles' ex-wife.
We were right at the other end of the table.
The pleb end.
Well, it was
practically
weird.
In the kitchen.
I don't know if I can talk about this. We'll discuss this later, Ben, whether we can talk about this. We used to have some people who came to all of the gigs, and they haven't really come recently, but they were butlers. Remember the butlers who used to come?
Actual butlers.
And I just thought, well, someone posh in North London has a butler. They worked at Buckingham Palace. And they were working on that day that we were there. And I didn't know. And I was saying to Greg, I said, we've got a couple of people who come and see the podcast who are butlers here. You know, I wonder if they're around. And one of them was serving me food just as I said that. And I didn't recognise her because they look like that down there. Don't they? They don't like butlers. And they were lovely couple. They're butlers.
Did they sneak you any extras in?
No, not really, no. They were nice, though. They said they could, you know, they couldn't say it. They said afterwards they couldn't say it. They weren't allowed to chat. Yeah. Hey, Rich, it's us from the podcast. We shat in your food. Princess Anne was very nice. Out of all of them, she's the best one, Princess
Anne.
Yeah,
she's the best one, isn't she?
Not Prince Anne. I could tell you some stories about Prince Andrew. Hi, Ben.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ben.
No, it's all right. Good, yeah. So, and also, there's a lot of Take a Break Tales, which was about, like, little stories that would have been in...
I wrote Take a Break Tales, so I took stories from Take a Break and turned them into little plays. And in my head, this was like a collection of Greek tragedies.
Yeah.
I was like some amazing, you know, Greek writer who I can't remember the name of. 13-week-old baby.
Euripides.
Yeah, something like that. And I thought that's what it'd be like. And then everybody... I mean, Take a Break magazine gave me a mug. It's kind of the best thing that happened.
Yeah. You won an award for... You won a Best Show award for that, didn't you?
No.
According to Wikipedia, you did.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, if I did, then no one told me.
Time out.
I feel like I've missed out.
Yeah.
No, Time Out, that was for Best Newcomer for Stand-Up. No,
there was something else.
But yeah, no, I think it's because I really like doing stand-up, but I get frustrated by the medium. I get frustrated by the idea that you can't go on a bit of a journey. Like, you can't... I think it's really hard to create a different world. I really like working on stage with other people, which obviously you can't do as a stand-up.
Yeah.
And also, I find it a bit frustrating sometimes when you come out in front of an audience. Not this audience, obviously. When you're doing a club gig as a stand-up or even a tour show and you come out and you're immediately having to win them over. And when you do any piece of theatre, like, so I did a play at the Donmar, and the audience are so like, so what's going to happen? And they're so excited, and they've bought money to see this story, whereas stand-up's so combative that the audience are like, well, come on then, impress us.
Yeah.
And I get really fed up with that sometimes, like the idea that I'm not allowed, you're not given that leeway to maybe do something a bit more interesting. You have to get out there and slam people down. And I remember once doing the Comedy Store, doing a 10-minute slot at the Comedy Store, and being told backstage that it's just crowd control. And I'm sure that, like, some stand-ups love that, but for me, that's not what I ever wanted to do.
But there's lots of... In fact, you were, when I came back to stand-up, you were running an amazing club at the Betsy Trotswood.
Yeah, that was a good
club. Upstairs, where you deliberately had kind of weird and wonderful and more
Andrew characters. Andrew Lawrence.
Andrew Lawrence was on
Andrew
scene.
Lawrence do it.
It's all your fault.
Who knew?
But, you know, so you can find... Well, you found your own way through that, though.
Yeah, but that's a very tiny... That's a very tiny room, and I think sometimes as a stand-up there's this idea that you should be able to play any room, and I don't know, I vacillate between the idea that if you're a great stand-up you should be able to play any room, and actually if you're a great stand-up you know exactly what you do, and sometimes it will work and sometimes it will fail, and I always have trouble deciding which one I think is true.
I don't think you should be able to play every room. I think a really great stand-up can't play every room, because some rooms are unplayable or some rooms aren't about doing stand-up.
Yeah.
So, you know, like you say, so those rooms, and the guys who do those rooms are amazing. Because it is about just going, people are going to shout stuff and throw stuff and you've got to come back and win them round.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing to do. But that's not really being... it's not the stuff you're talking about. I'm not saying one's better than the other.
Yeah.
Except your stuff is better than what they're doing. artistically speaking. But, you know, it's an impressive skill. But no one... I mean, some people can do a variety of things. But I think it's, you know, jack of all trades rather than master of one particular one. You know, you can do different things
and still
be good at them, but I think you to try and do every room I think is insane.
Yeah,
because like some rooms are just, you know, so like if you did Donald Trump's golf course, you know,
probably wouldn't
like you very much, and you can't go, I'm not a good comedian because those guys.
Well, I don't know because I stopped doing stand-up when I was pregnant because I could not cope with the overwhelming self-hatred I'd have if a gig went badly.
Right.
I couldn't deal with that anxiety, and because I was pregnant I wasn't allowed to drink and take over the counter codeine, which is what I'd normally do, so I found it really difficult. I had to stop doing it.
You've got to stop caring and care, you still care. I just think what you're doing is what you've done and what you're carrying on doing is incredible. All these different things are. So your last show was your last show the one about the being 17?
Yes, it was. I just remembered there was a write-up of I think it's Carrick Circus in The Guardian, and James Kettle had written, she clearly doesn't care about her career. A lovely way of putting it.
I think out of everyone I know, you do you take it quite personally and get quite cross about people, don't you? I think you're quite, you know, you're angry, and lots of comedians are bitter, and I don't think you're bitter, but you're cross. But you're cross about, and I understand it, because you know I've created lots of things, and I've done lots of Edinburgh extravaganza things, plays and things that are bigger that have not done well.
Do you know, I'm less cross now. I think when I was younger I would get really like, why isn't anybody recognising my genius? You know, like Albert Einstein used to do when he was in his post office. I used to get really angry about it, and now I sort of, it's difficult, because I remember once being on a train with Bridget Christie and saying to her, I'm motivated neither by money nor wanting to make people laugh, which means I'm in a really bad job. But I get, like, I think the thing that's weird is when you look at stand-up, and I don't know if you get this as well, you can see that, obviously, if you are hugely successful and you really work at it and you find the right sort of material, you could earn an incredible amount of money. You could be, like, properly insanely rich if you do it properly. And part of me always thinks, can I do that? Am I good enough to do that? But I don't really want to, because it's not who I want to be. But there's part of me that's like, maybe I should give it a go. Whenever I try and give it a go, whenever I try and be that, I remember once my manager, when I was with the management that you are currently with, when I was with them, I remember my manager saying to me, maybe if you just try being a little bit more like Russell Kane. It's like, walk out on stage, people think you're really grumpy. Just, you know, just cheer up a bit. And so I do wonder if maybe if I... But I don't think I don't think I've got it in me. I'm not a light entertainer.
No, but both Bridget and Stuart are in the position where they're making, presumably, a huge amount of money performing to loads of people every night. And they're both, you know, Bridget's a very good example of someone who was doing... I think you're very similar. I saw you both first probably in the caves in The Gilded Balloon.
Yeah, we were
and, you
caves.
Know, and doing really weird stuff. I mean, her stuff's, like, less weird, but it's still no less... comedically interesting.
Well, I think her, but she started off being more weird.
Yeah, no, like, she was weird and she's got less weird. But
what's the thing that I was a real turning point for me in terms of where I what I do now? I mean, look, I'm mainly a writer, to be honest. Now, in 2012, both me and Bridget took shows up to the Fringe about feminism and misogyny. Hers was War Donkey, mine was Speakeasy, and my show discussed all of the different weird jobs I've had and the sexism that I faced. This is in 2012, and Bridget's was about women in other countries and how they face misogyny. And we both got like loads of 2-star reviews going, it's just a woman talking about being a woman on stage. Oh, can you not just do universal subjects like penises and things like that? You know the sort of material that we can all relate to, like spunking over a prostitute. Can't you do that sort of thing? We've both got these sorts of reviews basically slamming us for doing material that was quite female-centric. Yeah. And I remember bumping into Bridget in the street saying, oh, I'm getting awful reviews. And she was like, I'm getting awful reviews as well. And that's when I said, I can't do it anymore. Like, if I can't go out on stage and be a woman and talk about being a woman, if I have to pretend that I am some asexual being for an audience and a bunch of reviewers to like me, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I can't be who I want to be. And Bridget said, do you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to do even more next year. I'm going to do like a more feminist show. That's even more, even if it ruins my career. And I was like, well, good luck with that, mate. And she won the Perrier and I stopped doing it.
But, you know, but that's what the whole business is like, you know. And there's these decisions you make, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong, and, you know, and someone gets picked up and someone doesn't get picked up. I mean, there was a lot of people doing brilliant shows about feminist shows around that time.
Yeah.
And Bridget was the one that kind of captured the public mood maybe the most, but it's, you know, it's, there's a lot of luck involved in that. But what's in, I know, I think what is admirable and better is you're just, you know, you're carrying on and doing all these different things, and that ultimately I think when you get to the end you would, you know, of your life, and you look back, you go, I'm glad I did that crazy robot nun Elton John thing. I'm glad I did that.
No,
that existed, you know. I know you will be, but you know rather than going, I played the Apollo and the 5,000 people came and laughed about my jokes about, you know, certain biscuits.
I mean, all I really want is the bronze statue in my that looks like me in the middle of Fareham Shopping Centre.
Okay,
that's all I want.
That'll be fine.
I remember, like, at the age of 13,
I haven't even got any connection to Fareham. Just that's what I wanted to be.
When I was 13, telling my religious studies teacher that all I ever wanted was a beautiful statue. I don't think it's asking a lot.
As long as that's happened, you can be at the end, you can be okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell you what, if it hasn't happened, when you die, if I'm still alive, which is quite unlikely, I'll cover you in bronze and stick you up in Fareham.
Easy solution, yeah, right? Is. They could just dip me in something.
And then it'll just be your withered old corpse. Quite scary. It'll be good. You wrote this show, which I didn't see, about being 17.
Yeah.
But I read that you wrote to 4 famous people in 1996.
I did.
And 2 of them you don't mention in the show.
Yeah.
Rob Newman and Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
And who were the other? Why didn't you write to me? And who else did you write to?
I don't know why I didn't write to you. I remember going to see you. I think I saw... Because this is very exciting for me, because I was a big Fist of Fun fan. Mm. Loved it. In fact, it was... There was a really lovely article that Stu wrote after Marky Smith died about being a Fall fan.
Yeah.
And about how the Fall introduces you to other bands. And that's what happened to me. Like, I got into the Fall listening to your radio show. It wasn't anything to do with you, obviously. listen to your radio show. And that's when I think I bought my first Fall album when I was 16 because I loved Fist of Fun.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was the radio show before you had your TV show. And that got me into so much other music. And it is like the Fall really are an education in music. And so you can sort of plot the lineage of your musical taste through that. And like, so it was really interesting to see that it started from you two.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, I wrote to Stuart Lee and Rob Newman and Gary Barlow and Brett Anderson. These were, I know, what a collection. But as I say in my show, I had a fanzine. You remember fanzines?
I do remember fanzines.
You used to have a fanzine. I had a fanzine that I wrote when I was like 16, 17. And we'd have interviews with people. And so, because no one in a band would ever write back.
Right.
Because they were all too snooty. But all the comedians loved it.
Yeah.
So if you write to a comedian saying, can I ask you some questions? They'd be like, yeah, sure. And so I remember writing to Rob Newman and Stuart Lee just with this, a list of questions. I most of the questions I asked you were really pointless. But I remember one was, who would you prefer? Who is a better captain, Kirk or Picard?
Right.
And he said, Picard is a humanist genius.
Yes.
And he said that Kirk was a bully. Yeah. I do remember that. So I wrote to those two. But when I wrote to Gary Barlow, it was hate mail.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So...
did he respond?
He didn't reply. I didn't actually do it, but what I... Because I mentioned this, like, I thought it'd be amazing. Gary Barlow really loves chocolate oranges, as we all know. So what I did was I wrote on a little tiny piece of paper, Gary Barlow, you are a prick. And I put it in the middle bit, you know, the middle bit of a chocolate orange where the stem is.
Yeah.
I took the stem out of the chocolate orange and put this little bit of paper in it and wrapped it up. But I never sent it to him. But I did do it. And then I thought, this is really mental. Should not be doing this. But I did genuinely send Brett Anderson a bra. Never sent anybody else a bra. Don't get jealous.
Why did you send him a bra?
Because I loved him. I thought
It was like your own bra. I thought it was like a bra for him. I think this might help with your boob problem, Brett.
It wasn't even my bra. Okay. I'd gone out and bought it because, like, when you're young, bras are very expensive. So
yes.
I didn't want to send Brett Anderson my own bra because they cost... I was like a 34F. And so my bras cost 20 quid from Bravissimo. They're really expensive. So I went to the market and bought a bra. But I bought a grey sports bra, thinking that would be sexy, which it wasn't. And so I sent him this grey... and he didn't reply anyway.
Reply,
he didn't reply.
He was too busy wanking into that bra. So I'll tell you that. Didn't have time. When I went... I did a gig in... where was I? It was Northampton a couple of years ago, and Shane from Westlife was on in the big venue, and I was next door, and there was like a bra. As I came out into my merch, there was a bra just on the steps outside. So it's like someone had shot their bolt a bit early or late. You'd throw it at him on the stage. He wouldn't wait. Oh,
yeah.
I'll put it on the steps so that he can get it on his way out.
Are bras sexy without breasts in them?
I don't think so. I mean, like, if you were 13, if you were a 13-year-old boy and a girl sent me a bra, that would be sexy.
But I totally misjudged it.
I think,
what's the weirdest thing you've been sent?
we did get some. We sort of requested people to send in stuff because we did the gallery on this one, so we got like a lot of strange.
I got a picture on the gallery.
Did you?
Yeah.
Which one was yours?
I got a dog with Marky Smith's head on it.
Okay, well, that was bound to get.
Yeah, well, of course, wasn't it? I mean, I knew my audience.
The one I remember, just because last week we were talking about Brian May. Was Brian May made out of... because someone had done Brian May made out of licorice and sweets, which would make John Robbins furious, because it was all about his hair being ridiculous, wasn't it?
That's nice.
To make it, doing it in licorice form. But I'm sure I've been... I mean, you get some...
Since you've got old, what is the best thing anybody sent you?
Yeah, but that's it. It all dries up. Everything dries up. This is a weird thing and a nasty thing.
Yeah.
I wrote a blog about cycling and getting wet on my bicycle, and somebody sent a pair of waterproof trousers to my home address.
Oh, that is weird.
Yeah. So, and no note, and no, just like, they that's, And so that's like a little bit going, I know where you were. They, and they didn't know, they put like two numbers on, they put the next door on my, so they knew where I lived roughly. And it got to me because it had my name on it. And it's the most, and it's horrible. I just threw them in the bin. But I
do you think
away.
It was Stuart Goldsmith who said
it?
Could have
been, but he knows where I live. He knows exactly.
He knows the actual number.
Him and Nish Kumar lived right behind me, so they could have just thrown it over the fence like they did with all those eggs. Or just a chat in my front garden like they did. So.
I sort of admire that, though. I feel a bit... like as a woman, you get like hate mail. We get like abuse on Twitter.
Yeah.
Part of me is like, oh... I need to make the effort to find out where I live and write it in blood.
Don't say that. But you know, like as a comedian, it's not. It's just annoying that someone thinks it's just because it's someone saying, you know, that it's a sort of message there, isn't it? It's a message of power. It's just annoying. But you know, as a comedian, people know where you are. It doesn't. You don't need to have our address again. If we say, hey, I'm going to be the Leicester Square Theatre, yeah. Same thing. Oh, great. Thanks. Thanks for the feces. it is interesting. I think a lot of comedians were obsessive about something, whether it's, you know, with musicians. I was obsessed about comedians. I didn't hate music. I wasn't interested in music. I was interested in comedy. But a lot of comedians do seem to be like obsessive about musical acts.
So the sport or music, and then the really famous comedians don't like anything. They don't. They don't have any interest. I was growing up, I loved music. I was like really, really into my music. But I also really love my comedy. I think I might have mentioned it on another podcast, but the first thing I ever went to see, I went to see Cannon and Ball when I was 9 years old. I loved them so much. I loved the film The Boys in Blue, which I watched again recently and is not a good film. I know that like those two can't act, but they've got everybody else and it can't act either. the key to being good in something is get everybody who's better than you around you. I was so obsessed with Cannon and Ball, and my parents have zero interest in what I do for a living. They've never been to see anything I've ever done, ever. They've only visited London now I've had a baby. I have issues. We don't have to get into it. But the one thing they did, they knew I loved Cannonball. So when I was nine, they took me to Butlin to see Cannonball. And it was amazing. And like, it was really good. I remember like it was a Thursday evening. And my mum said, if you could see anything at the weekend, what would it be? And I went, not Cannonball. My mum went, yeah, Cannon and Ball. Took me to Bognor.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I got some Rock on Tommy braces and everything.
I remember, honestly, when their first series came out, I was maybe, I don't know, I feel like I was 10, but maybe I was a bit older than that. But it was genuinely, I remember me and my sister just pissing ourselves with it. It was amazing.
They have no material. It's all stage presence.
Yeah, yeah.
They're brilliant.
Yeah. And Rick Mayall was in a sketch with, have you seen the sketch?
Yeah,
with
the sketch, yeah, in the shop.
Yeah.
That shop sketch.
Yeah. You met Debbie McGee the other day.
I didn't meet her.
How didn't you?
No.
Fell in love with her. Though.
I fell in love with her. My mum made me go to Strictly Come Dancing Live with her on Saturday. And bearing in mind, like, I've got a 13-week-old baby. He got to this fucking arena 2 hours early. And I was so grumpy. I sat on a piece of concrete going, could have been in bed. I was really annoyed. And so I got really quite pissed. I was like, oh, these dancing cunts. And by this, that's my mum, obviously. Mum was going, oh, they're amazing, aren't they? Yeah, they're really good. And everybody was fine. They were all right. But David McGee's amazing. She was, like, properly amazing. And she... And, like, you know, some of them get a bit emotional about what they're doing, and some of them are like, oh, thank you so much for voting for us. And Devin McGee's just like, I'm having a great time. She's 60 years old and her husband's dead.
You do impressions of David Bowie, Chris Marshall and Adrian Childs. Go. No. Do them all being in a pub and having a conversation.
I didn't know. Actually, I can't even remember. I did in my 2009, I had a show. I had an acting telephone and I did Chris Marshall.
How did you do Chris Marshall?
I don't know. I can't even remember what I did. I cannot remember. And the David Bowie, I did some really obscure David Bowie references that no one ever got and everybody thought was shit. And then for Adrian Childs, I did a man... really hating plain crisps So he was like, the joke where he was like, oh, I mean, because it was about, you know, Gary Lineker also hosted. Gary Lineker hosted Match of the Day. Adrian Charles hosted Match of the Day too.
Okay.
And I set up this idea of a rivalry between. It was very complicated. The backstory was worthy of at least three episodes of a Netflix series. and he hated plain flavoured crisps. Right. And I just pretended to be sick. It was all right. No one liked it. If I'd been a bloke, they'd have loved it. It's a woman.
I saw Adrian Charles in Cafe Nero in Hammersmith once, and he had the same computer as me. I said, how are you getting on with it? He said, all right.
Who's the most famous person you've spoken to in London? Do you still get excited when you see famous people?
Yeah, of course. Who have I spoken? I don't know, but I'm too shy to speak to people. I don't know why I spoke to Adrian Charles. Yeah. It's just because he had a Sony Vaio. He had the little Sony Vaio. It's nice. Must have been a long time ago because I haven't had I've had Macs for so long now. It was back in the day when Adrian Charles was still famous.
No,
they will, they won't, they was going on. Time passes by quickly, doesn't it? I don't know. Who have I said? I did see some. I keep forgetting. I saw some people this week, I think. But I'm too old to remember it now.
You're trying to function on about was, 4 hours sleep.
Yeah, I've got a bug, and you know, I looked after my son last. It's nice when they sleep in bed with you. But then I'm always worried I'll roll over and crush him to death.
I can't do that. Yeah, I'm genuinely worried that.
Yeah, but then you know,
some sleep. It would
shut him up, wouldn't it? So nice, so lovely.
My friend was saying to me, she said, oh, you know, when they sleep through the night, it's amazing. And what will happen is you'll wake up and they won't have woken you up and you'll think, are they dead? And if they are dead, it's going to be a really hard day, so I should definitely stay in bed a little bit longer. But, you know, the police will come round. I'm going to need all my strength.
But I can't do it. I've had exactly that, but I have to get up because what if they only just died and you could get them back alive again in time? So you can't.
So you've got to
spring out of bed, make sure, and then they go, why wake me up? My daughter was sick all over the bed the other day. It was great. She just threw up. It's nice when it's your turn. And then all day she was going, I was sick on the bed. What fun it is having kids, eh? You have used Sting's toilet?
I have used Sting's
toilet. Tell me about Sting's toilet.
Sting's toilet's really weird. So I was in a play called Julius Caesar by Shakespeare.
But that's all men in that. You couldn't be in that.
I was in the all-female production. I was in the original all-female production, right. Not in the version that has been filmed where we all got sacked and some other people did it.
Really?
I was in the original all-female Julius Caesar, yeah. And it was on at the Donmar. Actually, I met Patrick Stewart. It was really exciting.
Yeah.
Dame Harriet Walter introduced me. I said, I love Patrick Stewart. Can I meet Patrick Stewart? She said, yeah. And so he was being all like regal and Shakespearean around everybody. And then she said, this is Danielle. She really loves Star Trek. And he just fucked off. He wasn't interested at all. So I was in a production of Julius Caesar, which transferred to New York. And that was quite exciting, being in a play. In Brooklyn. People go, you're in Broadway. But no, it was in Brooklyn. And Sting came to see it and had a party at his house for all of us and some other people. Like, I think Trudy Styler was also doing the Seagull at the same time, his wife.
Okay.
And so she'd had this party for all of the Brits on Broadway and in Brooklyn. And so it was us and the production of The Seagull and Twelfth Night as well. So Mark Rylance didn't go to the party, but Stephen Fry did.
Oh,
and he said to me, who do you play? And I said, I play Lepidus. And he started quoting the entire bit. And I went, I've only got four lines, but I won't know. And I needed to use the toilet.
Yeah.
And I went into Sting's toilet. And everybody was going to me, you have to, Sting's toilet's amazing. You have to use Sting's toilet. I was like, this must be a really great, like a Japanese toilet or something. Maybe it talks. And I went into Sting's toilet. And the whole toilet, like this... The ceiling and the walls and the floor and the sink and the toilet itself were all bright red. like everything was red,
yeah.
Completely red. And it was the most frightening toilet I've ever been in. It was like going to toilet in The Shining.
Yeah.
It was so weird. And everybody's going, it's amazing, it's a design masterpiece. And I was like, I don't understand why you would have a red toilet unless your arsehole bled a lot. I don't get it. And the toilet paper was red as well. That was the weird thing, because the toilet paper was also red, and it was all very...
How can you tell when you're done?
Well, exactly. Just all looks the same, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, and I have a photo on my phone of me in Sting's toilet going... it was really weird. Yeah. But I feel bad discussing it, because he is a real man who let me into his real toilet.
Yeah. And now here you are.
I know. I don't want to... I feel like he let me into his house. I feel really bad discussing his toilet. What if he heard about the podcast?
He does listen to it a lot. He always emails me after every show and lets me know how it's gone. It'd be fuming.
But how would you feel if someone...
I know Rachel Paris from the MASH Report. Yeah. Very successful now. She's been on the podcast.
Yeah.
She's now viral now. It's all down to me. She came to my house because she was doing a gig with my wife.
Yeah.
And she used my toilet.
Yeah.
And she texted her brother and said, I'm on Rich Herring's toilet. So I know exactly how it feels. I feel violated.
Yeah. It's
how dare
possible.
You come into my toilet and text people about it. And discuss what it's like just because it's all brown. The whole it wasn't when it started. But
my partner will not. He hates toilet brushes. He won't have a toilet brush.
Right.
He thinks they're disgusting and weird. Like, why would you want a brush full of poo in your next to your toilet?
Yeah, the problem with that though.
Yeah, the toilet gets dirty. And then he was like, "Oh no, it's fine. I'll clean the toilet. We don't need a toilet brush. I'll clean it with my hands." Never has done. The toilet's horrible.
But now you've got a kid with him. You're stuck with him.
Yeah, I know.
That's what happens.
And also, he's got more money than me. So yes. Might as well.
Why is he Scottish?
He's half Scottish.
Is he?
He's a Buchanan. They had a family castle at one point.
Hey.
Yeah.
God.
I know.
Well, he's good looking as well.
He's good looking, isn't he?
He's like posh, but he's also good looking.
Yeah.
So it's the best of both
worlds.
Well,
he's only half posh, so his mum's posh, but his dad isn't posh.
Okay, his dad's from York, is he?
His dad's from... I think his dad's from South Shields, and they moved to York. But they their family home was on Hope Street in St Andrews, which is where Andrew and Katie lived. That's how posh they are.
Andrew and Katie.
Oh, no, Andrew and Katie. William and Katie.
Yeah, be good. Prince Andrew, that's the kind of thing he would do. They have a secret life with his nephew's wife. Couple of those kids. I mean, that's bad, isn't it? If a couple of those kids are... No, that's fine. It's all right. It's all right. No, it'll be okay, because she's not related to him.
No, she's fine. No.
That's fine. That's Prince Andrew wouldn't be interested in that, because that's... that's acceptable. So, what's the point?
You don't want a knighthood.
Just beep it. Just beep it. So you were also... Well, your first gig is interesting, because you were... Why have I not talked about this? You were an economic researcher at the South Korean embassy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about all the news. You know about economics, and you know about South Korea, North Korea. Let's go.
When I went there in 2000... I think I got the job in 2003. I went there 2003, 2004. And even then, they were not that... They didn't hate North Korea in the way I thought they would.
Right.
They were very much like, our poor misguided brothers. That was their attitude. So it was never a thing of, we hate North Korea in the embassy. I can't speak for all Koreans. they call themselves... You're not allowed to call them South Koreans. That's not what they...
Yeah.
It's like the Republic of Korea and the Democratic People's... It's very... You're not allowed to use North and South.
Right.
But they were very much like, we can't wait the day... Can't wait for the day when we can all... do curling together or whatever it is. Whatever it is, it's brought them
then
back
we
together.
Can play women's ice hockey as a one united nation, then we'll all be happy again.
Then we'll all be happy. So they were pretty chilled about it.
How did you get that job as working as... Had you done economics?
No, I hadn't done economics, didn't know any Korean, Korean people, hadn't ever been to North Korea or South Korea. It was advertised in The Guardian for an economic researcher and they just wanted someone with a degree. And when I went for the job interview, everybody else was mental. So you just gave it me.
So if you'd stayed in that job and not... So you did comedy while you were working there.
Yeah, I started doing comedy while I was working there.
Yeah.
Partly because when you work in an embassy, they don't have to give you the same work laws. The same work laws don't apply.
Right.
So they didn't have to give me 20 days paid holiday, for example. And they didn't have to, like, they wouldn't have had to have given me maternity pay if I'd have got pregnant or sickness or anything like that. So in my first year, I got 9 days holiday. And I was like, fuck this. It's ridiculous. And when I only worked there for about, I think it was like less than 18 months. And when I left, the head of admin sat me down and told me what a terrible person I was and how I had an awful attitude. I know, I was fine.
Yeah. So your first gig, was it Russell? Was it Russell Brand's gig, or Russell Brand was on?
He was comparing. It was downstairs at the King's Head.
All right.
Yeah, it was all right.
Yeah.
It was all right gig.
And you did all right?
I think when I first started, I had some really interesting material and I was a terrible, terrible performer and I wasn't really... So I got loads and loads of heat when I... This is the thing. If anybody is like a new comic and they talk about going to Edinburgh... A friend of mine wants to go to Edinburgh and she hasn't even done stand-up yet. She's an actor. And she's like, I'm going to do an hour of stand-up in Edinburgh. What do you reckon? I was like, you haven't got any material yet. And I was saying, you don't burn your first... Like, because the opportunity you get when you first hit the scene is... Like, you'll never get that back again. So the later you can do that, the better you'll be. And I had got loads of heat when I first started, and I was nowhere near good enough to make it work. Like, I just wasn't good enough to capitalise on it. And it's not even a regret, because it's how things worked out. And I didn't get into comedy. I didn't even start doing comedy because I thought it would be a career. It was just a thing that I did. Like, I did some gigs. I loved comedy. Yeah. I did some gigs. And for some reason, it became my job. It was never a career plan. So... When I first started, like, I'd been doing it about 8 months when I was runner-up in the BBC New Comedy Awards, and there was no sort of plan to be a comedian. And I was a bit, oh, I don't know, I didn't have a manager or an agent or anything like that, and I didn't know what I was doing. And so I got all this traction, and the Russell Brand thing was part of that. Like, he got me to go and do his gig at the Enterprise in Chalk Farm, and I'd do that, and that's where I met Trevor Locke and Lee Francis and all these, like, brilliant comedians. And I'd be like, what am I doing here? But it's because I had weird material. And I sometimes feel a bit sad that I've lost that attitude of, this isn't even my job, so it doesn't matter what I do. I feel sad that sometimes you lose that, especially when you go and do a gig and, you know, the promoter's going, well, I'm taking a chance on you because you're a lady. You think, oh, I have to do that slightly bog standard 20 minutes rather than the 20 minutes that I know might not appeal to everybody, but is the 20 minutes that is me as a comic.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm surprised. No, I was surprised when I read this, because I came back to do stand-up about 2004, 2005.
Yeah.
And I remember doing gigs with you, and I thought you were, you know, really established and been going for ages at that point. So I was surprised when, you know, you were very good, I think, straight off the bat then.
Well...
Because I thought you must have been going for 4 or 5 years.
No, I was... Stage. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what happened. It's all about...
But I think, you know, but you just got to do what you think's good. The minute you start... When I came back to stand-up, I'd done that. The first time I'd done stand-up, I'd really vacillate and gone, oh, should I do what I want, or should I do what the club will book me for?
Yeah.
And I'd do something in between, and it was usually terrible.
And it doesn't work, yeah.
You know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it really wouldn't, but it'll be, you know, just... Pick one, I think, and the one you should pick is to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
And so when I came back to do stand-up, I just went, fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, and did, you know, stuff that annoyed people on purpose for ages.
But I remember doing a gig in Edinburgh in 2006, and a comic who is quite famous, so I won't name them, said to me afterwards, you will never smash the roof off a gig with that material. And I was like, well, this is my set. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was really... And you sort of think, well, should I change it then? Should I do something else? Should I do something more accessible? I remember doing... I did, like, just a 10-minute slot about 5 years ago with two comics that had really good fringe runs. And I was like, oh, this will be a really good gig because they're both quite weird. And when I did this club gig, I think it was the Glee or something, and the material they were doing was really quite conventional.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you meant to have a different set? And that was the other thing. I've been going for like 10 years and I didn't realise you're meant to have your Edinburgh set and then you have the set that earns you money. It never occurred to me that... Yeah. You would have these different... Because I'm an artist. So.
No, but then that's better. Also, anyone who talks about smashing the roof off a gig is a cunt. And
yeah.
You can forget about it. Because you might do that, but it's not. That's, you know, that sort of says what they're aiming for. And it's a different thing, you know. It's not...
You just want
well, it's just aiming about... It's,
silence.
It's aiming about the ego. That's an ego thing. Being, oh, I did this, I did that. You know, you might make an audience really laugh. And you might, but also... a good gig, you're not going to smash the roof off. You're going to make people have an amazing time all the way through.
Yeah.
And it's not going to get to a point where it explodes and no one can follow it.
I don't think you meant literally.
In that case,
he wasn't a member of ISIS.
I say he, of course, it could have been a woman.
It could have been, obviously.
Talking in that way.
Oh, obviously,
wasn't that one. Terrific. Well, look, I haven't asked you any emergency questions again. People will be very disappointed. But screw those people. I'm better than that. I'm not just a guy who... GoFasterStripe.com by this... I'm not going to ask you the ham hand.
What was the talc one? Would you rather have a tip full of talc? What was it?
I'm not going to do that.
What was the talc one?
Get to the 2018, Danielle. we're not living back in 2017 anymore. We're not living in December 2017. This is February 2018 now. What is the sexiest TV puppet? I have asked that before. What is the sexiest TV puppet?
Oucho.
What's that from?
Ed and Oucho. What would you want me to say? Like Muffin the Mule, Grandad?
I want to say what you believe.
Think it's Muffin the
Mule? I don't know what Oucho is.
You know who Oucho is, right? They're all really old. I'm young and I'm down with the cool. I knew who Rihanna is and everything.
I'm gonna have to look. Oucho's
a cactus.
That's not sexy.
It is. Think of the. Do you not know the pleasure pain thing?
No. Ouchie or Oucho?
Oucho.
Ouchie.
I just thought of all of the comics I know, you'd be the one most into autoerotic asphyxiation.
I'm very vanilla. It's like an angry, it's like a cactus with hair on
cactus.
It. Yeah, that.
Yeah, sexy cactus.
That slightly turned you on seeing that picture.
A little bit. I mean, look at those guns.
Wouldn't it be prickly though? It was nasty.
I mean, it's a puppet though.
Okay.
It's just like a ribbed penis.
Has he got a badge of himself? Is he wearing a badge of himself?
He is, yeah. You do that, though.
I like his open mouth, I have to say. That is appealing to me.
Sexiest puppet.
Okay, good. I've discovered a new puppet. That's something I didn't think I would do tonight. All right, we'll go for one more. There was some. Well, you worked with John Oliver on the. I want to keep calling it the Mash Report, but it's the Milk Run.
On the Milk Run, yeah.
Yeah.
He's great, isn't he?
He is great.
Are you jealous?
I'm not jealous of him.
Are you not?
No.
I'm jealous of him.
Are you? I think with all the. I'm not. I don't really. Despite everything that this podcast would make you think.
Yeah.
I think any of the people, like John and Stuart, have taken their individual journey and stuck with it and made it really fucking work. And I think that, as really as any comedian, that should make you go, there's hope. And when you look at John, I would never have pegged him out as being, and I loved him, but I would never have thought, there's a guy who's going to go to America and become the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
But someone took a chance on him and gave him a chance to do what he does well. And it's amazing. And I couldn't ever do anything like that.
Absolutely. Like I now, when I look at John Oliver, I don't think of it as being the John Oliver that I know.
Right.
If you see what I mean? Like, you did gigs with John Oliver, like, 14 years ago, and that's very different from... He's sort of so brilliant. I can't really equate the two.
Yeah. Good. Good. I'll ask you... Let's see what the emergency question generator throws up. How do you spell diarrhea?
Is that really what you want people asking each other over the Christmas dinner table?
It's D-I-A-R-R-H-O-E-A. I still don't believe it.
No.
Okay, sorry, that would cut that out, Ben. There's nothing else that's been cut out.
There's nothing left in the podcast.
Can you believe you read this far? Or are you just...
How much did you charge for this book?
Like a lot of money. One more go, Ben. We'll see if we'll get there. This book's good. This book has been nominated for a Chortle Award.
Has it?
It's so embarrassing. I wrote this like in about 2 days. It's up against all these brilliant... I've read all the other books. They're all brilliant. I would say vote for it. It's too late, but I'd love to beat them all just because it would be so funny. Robert Webb's heartbreaking tale of the death of everything.
You're up against...
Yeah. Imagine if that beats him, how annoyed he'll be. I just spelled diarrhea. I was going to read out the worst questions from it. It's James Acaster's book. It's the funniest book I've read in like 20 years. Adam Kay's book. We had Adam Kay on the other week.
Yeah,
and his book is amazing.
Yeah.
I want to go on, and I'm just going to accept the award. What is the strangest thing you've ever had up your anal canal? That is one. That is one. That beat you. That beat you, Robert Webb. I've lost it. I fucking lost it. I thought you would lose it because you're only 13 weeks into being a mother.
Yeah, 13 weeks and nearly died. Did you nearly die having your baby?
Well, it was very uncomfortable on the chairs. I tried to sleep on the chairs and it was impossible.
Oh, I just think,
I know, but Kate had a bed. Just lying all the way.
No,
the little thing just it came out of that. It was like bop.
Exactly like my partner, my boyfriend. He was like, "Oh, this bed's so uncomfortable." It's like, "Oh no, I just and 50 hours. I was 50 hours."
I know, but I've got to drive her home the next day. I've got to be awake and alert to look after them all. Think of the dads. They could just have a chair that goes back a bit, so you could go. Oh. They could just have these chairs. I could sleep on
it. The legs come out on the chairs. I nearly bled to death on the operating table when I had my C-section. And the worst thing is, because you're awake, you can hear them talking about how you're bleeding to death. They don't even do a code, like, on the tube. I think they'd have a code, wouldn't they?
Dr. Blood is coming out of the vagina.
Yeah.
A bit too quickly.
Can Mr. Gauze come to the uterus area? None of that. Yeah.
It's a terrifying thing, and that's an awe, awe-inspiring, terrible thing to go through.
Yeah, I've had worse gigs.
Yeah.
Honestly, my midwife said, "Do you want me to get you any trauma counselling?" Because it was like I say, 50 hours, nearly bled to death, went into shock. "Do you want me to get you trauma counselling?" And I was like, I honestly feel worse about the time I got booed off at the Comedy Cafe. I really do. It was a worse experience. That's the great thing about being a stand-up comedian.
And was there a part of your brain going, I can write a show about this. This is going to be a great routine. If I survive this, if we both survive this, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, when I stop dry heaving. Yeah. No, I didn't actually, because I thought, I'll just get told off by the list for writing about being a woman. The time I nearly die is not as exciting as my nan with some breakbeats. I went to see a show in the Fringe, and it was just like 50 minutes of bog standard stand up, white guy stand up, but my nan's dead, and then breakbeats over the top of it as well. Breakbeats over the top of me bleeding to death on a table. Maybe as the coda to the show.
I think you should do it. I think it would work.
Never mention it. Never mention it. And then just a picture of my rancid uterus being suctioned clean.
Luckily, I think. Luckily, I think Ben probably stopped recording this about 2 hours ago. We'll have got the intro. We'll have got like one story in the middle. I think was okay. You worked with that girl off Call the Midwife?
Yeah.
She was nice, wasn't she?
She was nice.
That's it. That's going to be it. That's going to be the podcast. What was she like in real life?
She is really lovely.
Yeah, she did seem lovely.
But she did work with me before she got famous. So, yeah.
Well, I think you made her famous. No,
genuinely did. She owes me. Yeah. I went to her wedding. The bottles of Heineken were £8.
At a wedding?
Yeah. I know. Fuck that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. They got divorced, it's fine.
They got divorced because the whole thing was a scam to make money off the Heineken. Got those for a quid at the supermarket, £7 each, bang. Split that, let's go. No idea how Ben's going to get through this. He's got a couple of weeks to put it together. And Chris Evans, like that one, of course, as well, does the video. So I've got to go to Hertfordshire now, so thanks for... I've got to go catch my train, so thank you for coming in. Ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Ward! You have been listening
thank you, Rich. Thanks. Let's spread the podcast with me, Rich Chang, and my guest, Danielle Ward. You can hear her on the Do the Right Thing podcast. Just Google that, you'll find her. The music is by Pest. Thank you also to everyone at GoFast Subscribe, everyone at Best Square Theatre, everyone at Rich Comedy Guide, and just everyone, all my friends from school, and everyone, my mum and dad, everyone who knows me. This was produced by Ben Walker. It's GoFast Subscribe, Sky Potato, Fuzz Production, for the internet.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.